Ladies and gentlemen, we have a deal. What exactly the USMCA is going to mean. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 10th of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. This was quite a day, huh? I mean, yes, sure, that other story, very big news. But to those of us for whom the economy is our concern, also big. After a couple of days of rumors, House Democrats announced this morning they have come to terms with the Trump administration on the new NAFTA, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement by name. It's been a bit more than a year since the deal was originally signed. So, on the theory that perhaps the details have faded from memory, Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has this refresher.
One of the long-standing criticisms of NAFTA is that it destroyed a lot of U.S. manufacturing jobs. The treaty allowed Mexico to export products to the U.S. duty-free, but wages are lower in Mexico. Doug Irwin teaches economics at Dartmouth College.
So what happened under NAFTA is that a lot of U.S. companies moved their assembly plants to Mexico, so the U.S. lost assembly jobs.
The original version of the USMCA tried to address that problem. It required Mexico to protect workers' right to unionize and to increase wages for at least some Mexican auto workers. Democrats wanted more than that.
One thing was for Mexico to promise that conditions would improve.
Gustavo Flores Macias teaches government at Cornell.
But another thing was for those conditions to truly improve, for the government to monitor conditions in factories, to make sure that whatever new regulations were in place would also be enforced.
He says Democrats proposed that the U.S. should be allowed to send inspectors into Mexican factories. Mexico said no. But in this new version of the deal, Mexico did agree to allow a panel of experts to make sure it's following the rules. It's not clear exactly how that'll work.
You know, it'll be interesting to see what exactly, you know, under which conditions these panels can be convened and who brings these cases.
Another sticking point for Democrats, the original deal would have given pharmaceutical companies 10 years to exclusively make certain kinds of drugs. Christopher Sands is a senior research professor at Johns Hopkins.
So it means 10 years in which generic copies cannot be made of a drug. And I think a lot of Democrats in the House saw this as really over the top.
Especially since drug prices have been on the rise. That part of the USMCA is gone now. And Democrats have also added some environmental rules. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Honestly, the first thing I thought of this morning when I heard the news was apples, specifically Washington State apples from the Yakima Valley.
My first reaction was a little bit of relief, mostly, that seems like we've cleared that hurdle.
That's Patrick Smith, our apple and hops farmer up in the Northwest. The hurdle, of course, being no free trade agreement with Canada and Mexico, his two biggest export markets.
For the apple industry here in Washington State, it was tens of millions of dollars of exports that were lost in the 2018 crop.
Not only because of the possibility of no more NAFTA, but also because of retaliatory tariffs from Canada and Mexico that sent his exports down 30% last year.
Getting a deal that would kind of clear all that out of the way and go back to some sort of state of normalcy is a really good thing for us.
A state of normalcy under the USMCA? No tariffs on his apple exports to Mexico and Canada, just like under NAFTA. But
we're not making any big decisions really on the basis of USMCA or anything. We're still kind of in wait-and-see mode and cautiously optimistic for improvements in trade relations.
Patrick Smith up at the family farm, Loftus Ranches in Washington State. Still going to be a couple of months before this thing is done, by the way. See also that other big story in the news today that's sucking all the air out of Washington. On Wall Street this Tuesday, kind of interesting, actually. No big moves on the new NAFTA news. Also no big moves on reports the U.S. and China are talking about putting off the next round of American tariffs. Those are due on Sunday. So, basically flat. In equities, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Tuesday is Election Day over in the UK, upon which the fate of Brexit not really at all arguably hangs. Leaving the European Union, or even the prospect of it, low these past 3.5 years, has affected the British economy in ways large and small, many of which we have touched on in one way or another. Here's one we haven't, though: fruit and vegetable farmers. Turns out there aren't enough seasonal migrants coming over to pick. Apparently, they feel less welcome now. And, hello, tangible impact of the foreign exchange markets, the drop in the value of the pound following the referendum has hurt the remittances that those workers send home. One answer? Technology. More from Marketplace's Stephen Beard at the European Desk in London.
It's been a great year for raspberries in Britain, but not for raspberry picking.
The problem now is that because of Brexit, we're experiencing labour shortages.
Hannah Trefgarn, a fruit farm manager, told ITV News this autumn her crops have been devastated by a dearth of seasonal workers from Eastern Europe.
So there are fields that we haven't picked, and in the fields that we are picking, we're seeing in some cases waste of up to 45% of those crops, and that's because we're late into the fields with simply not enough people.
Barely three quarters of the 70,000 migrants that British growers need showed up this season. Even fewer are expected next year. Quite a worry for a soft fruit industry that turns over more than $1 billion per annum. Could robots ride to the rescue? In his electronics lab at Essex University, Dr. Vishu Mohan is building a robot that could pick raspberries but is currently configured for another fruit.
Picking and packing strawberries, identifying their ripeness. We want to build a platform that has the dexterity of the human hand.
And the discernment of the human eye. Bristling with 3D cameras with two arms and mounted on a four-wheeled trolley, the robot can move along a line of strawberry plants, check out the redness of the fruit, and then snip the stem. Is it more complicated than car assembly?
It is more complicated because it's identifying berries which are hidden in between the leaves, precisely localizing the stem and cutting it without direct contact with the soft fruit. Soft fruits get damaged very quickly.
The prototype will be ready for a field trial next spring. Meanwhile, Octinion, a Belgian company, has already launched a strawberry-picking robot. Labour shortages are not confined to Brexit Britain. Higher living standards in poorer parts of Europe have cut the supply of migrant workers across the continent.
Having efficient, skilled personnel is a major headache for growers.
CEO Tom Cohen, based in the Belgian city of Leuven, won't tell us exactly how much his robot costs, but...
We guarantee the grower that the robot will have a similar cost to a human picker.
The robot is slower than humans, he says, but it can work non-stop around the clock.
And that's, of course, something that is quite a logistic challenge and also very hard to be cost-effective with humans, but it's perfectly feasible with the robot.
Octinion says it's had inquiries from as far afield as the US and Canada, but it clearly has its sights on Britain, where fruit farmers are under particular pressure.
The challenge for us is long-term labour security.
Chris Newenham of Wilkin & Sons in Tiptree, Essex. He grows fruit and makes jam. His seasonal workforce was down 20% this year. He says everything is now riding on robotics.
We cannot continue to grow our business until we have got the confidence that we've got a viable long-term solution to harvesting our fruit.
But he fears that in spite of the bullish claims, affordable and effective fruit-picking robots may not be fully deployed on British farms for 10 years. He and other British fruit growers face a tough decade. In Tiptree, Essex, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
You live in California, or really most anywhere in the American West, and you come to appreciate water, mostly because of how little of it there is and how much demand for it there is. Agriculture, of course, also cities and overall development. But it turns out farms and us non-farmers out here aren't the only ones arguing over water. Jesse Newman covers agriculture for the Wall Street Journal, and she had a story not so long ago headlined, "The Water Wars That Defined the American West Are Heading East." Jesse, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I have to tell you, every time I go east from California, I am struck by how much water there seems to be there, as opposed to the droughts that we have. But increasingly, you're saying that certainly in agriculture and some other things, that is not the case.
It's fairly counterintuitive. We tend to think of places in the east as home of devastating hurricanes, not water shortages. What we're seeing, though, is that there is greater and greater competition for water in the eastern U.S. thanks to a number of factors, among them the expansion of irrigated agriculture and rapidly growing urban populations. There's just more competition overall for water in the eastern U.S.
So let's get to irrigated water for a minute. And the case study you cite is a water dispute between Florida and Georgia, the details of which we're going to pass on. But fundamentally, farmers upriver from folks down in Florida are using the water to get better, more productive, and higher value crops, yes?
That's right. So farmers in Georgia and throughout the eastern U.S. have steadily embraced irrigated agriculture for the same reasons, really, that their counterparts out west did. Yeah. So the ability to control when and how much water your crops receive has brought huge benefits. Protection against drought, first and foremost, but also more reliable crops and bigger and more profitable harvests.
So, you know, it's funny. You drive up and down the Central Valley here in California, and you see signs that farmers, I mean, Central Valley being a huge agriculture area, you see signs that farmers have put up advocating for more water rights for themselves. And it's a limited resource, right? So that means somebody else doesn't get. Has it gotten that tense on the East Coast?
What we're seeing is an increase in Supreme Court cases that are adjudicating water rights. This Florida v. Georgia case that we referred to, this is one of three interstate water disputes that is pending before the Supreme Court today, two of which involve eastern states. And many of the water experts that I talk to believe that eastern states are pretty poorly prepared for even more conflicts over water, largely because they don't, unlike the West, they don't have a regulatory framework in place that can balance all of these competing interests.
Right. I mean, we've got, you know, interstate compacts out here that govern the Colorado River and all of those. Let me ask you one last thing, and it's a little hydrological, it's a little historical, and it's a little climate changey, I guess. And you talk about this a little bit in the piece, and you do a little reading, and you discover it's a fascinating thing. The 100th meridian, John Wesley Powell and the 100th meridian, right? The historical dividing line between the arid Southwest and the water using and having East. That line, because of climate change, is moving farther east, right? That is to say, it's getting drier more easterly.
Exactly. That's what these researchers found in a recent study. And already you've got farmers in Georgia's Flint River Basin who say they've noticed this marked shift in rainfall patterns. So while average annual precipitation might be holding steady, they see that rains are coming in fewer, larger storms, between which drought conditions can pretty quickly develop. So it's during these times that irrigation is such a key tool for farmers. You know, a farmer will tell you that 2 or 3 weeks without rain during a critical phase of crop development can really hurt yields or quality, and that's why they view irrigation as the most effective risk management tool that they have.
Jesse Newman writing in the Wall Street Journal the other day, a fascinating piece about the water wars coming to the East Coast in the United States. Jesse, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Coming up.
I had this passionate love for King Diamond and Slayer and Carnivore.
From 80s metal to the Latin music of today. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is off 27 today, about a 0.1%, closed to 27,881. The NASDAQ down 5 points, less than a 0.1, 86.16. The S&P 500 off 3, we'll call that flat, 31.32. Netflix dimmed 3.1% today after an analyst downgraded the stock. She predicted the streaming service would lose 4 million subscribers next year as it faces stiff competition from rival providers. Oh, hello, Walt Disney Company, owner of Hulu and Disney Plus. Shares there nudged down just a tad. Amazon, it of the Prime streaming service, gave back about a 0.5% today. Pet supply retailer Chewy bounced up 5.4% today. Late yesterday, posted third quarter revenue that beat expectations. Exercise equipment maker Peloton fell 5.7% after a research company wrote that the firm was overvalued and faced competition from cheaper rivals. It had nothing to do with that ad, people. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. I thought apples when I heard the new NAFTA news this morning. A whole lot of other people thought cars, because the deal, again, when it's approved in a couple of 3 months, is going to bring big changes to the way cars are made in North America. Marketplace's Scott Tong has that one.
The new trade deal requires a bigger portion of North American vehicles to be made by high-wage workers earning $16 an hour or more. And that will move jobs north and labor costs up, says trade analyst Simon Lester at the Cato Institute.
Bring production from Mexico to the United States. That's the goal of the Trump administration. And in doing so, I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that will raise the cost of producing the car.
The Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis finds that the deal may make North American cars less competitive in the world.
The analysis that I've seen suggests it actually will reduce the number of auto jobs in the United States.
The deal will help increase imported vehicles from outside North America, says the International Trade Commission. Now, this agreement also affects parts. The percentage of parts from North American countries will rise from 62% to 75%. And suppliers are already moving closer, says Jeffrey Schott at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
Some of the companies, recognizing that this is going to be in the New Deal, have begun to shift their supply chains.
But all this coincides with more fundamental changes in the business, says James Rubenstein. He's at Miami University in Ohio.
The auto industry is in the midst of great disruptions because of the autonomous vehicles and the electrification, and the cost of vehicles will be going up.
With all the uncertainty over changing technology, car makers say they are pleased that the trade and tariff picture is more clear. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
As with a whole lot of other industries, women in leadership positions in the music business are rare. Women of color in those jobs, almost vanishingly so. And sometimes when they move up the corporate ladder, those women decide they can make more of a difference by going out on their own. Billboard magazine has named Diana Rodriguez one of the most powerful women in music. She ran the Latin division at Capitol Music and now runs her own shop as the founder and CEO of Criteria Entertainment. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. I saw you referred to, as I was reading up on you before our chat, I saw you referred to as a longtime music mogul.
Yes, 28 years. Can you believe that? It's a lot of time.
Okay, so that's the long time part. Let's get to the music mogul part.
I don't know that I'm there yet. Those are very kind words. You know, music is ever-changing, ever-evolving, so it's an everyday learning experience, you know. These are shifting times and changing times, from formats to the way that people are consuming music, no? The experience. Mm-hmm. So it's always, you know, different in a way.
You do this thing called artist development.
Yes.
What does that mean?
It means we take, we're kind of like an incubator for artists, or that's what my company strives for. You know, I'm very against the cookie cutter form for artists, because each artist is really a human being with feelings and dreams and illusions, just like you and me, and different objectives. You know, there's artists that just want to be writers. There's some that want to go into the stadium. Some prefer to stay in the studio, you know. And it's figuring out what their voice is, where their audience is, you know, how much they engage. And I've been very fortunate to work with amazing artists, little breaking, consolidated legacy artists, you know.
Yeah.
And it's always very different.
Is there some degree of audience development you have to do too?
We do. We do, especially in the Latin markets.
Well, that's what
as well, you know, and in Latin markets like mine, Colombia, where I'm from, are a challenge because audiences not necessarily are used to discovery of new artists, and teaching, you know, audiences to discover, to be patient for that opening act, to go to the festival early and watch the first acts, you know.
It's, yeah, that's tough because people just want to see the big name people.
Exactly.
Right?
They want to see the hits, you know.
Right. You know, it's interesting. You've used the word discovery a couple of times.
Yes.
Clearly, a good part of what you do is fostering that discovery, right? Making it easier for people to discover your artists or your style and brand and whatever.
Exactly. And hopefully in a way that's not invasive, but that it's natural to you. That's part of your lifestyle.
But which is completely engineered by you, the music.
Exactly.
Moment, right?
So,
I mean, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So that you go into, you know, a store and you listen to the track. You go to the movies. Hopefully you can see it sync and license. You hear it on the radio. So in a way, it's catering to your lifestyle, but also to that artist.
Were you a metalhead growing up when you were a kid?
Yes.
How did you make that transition from metalhead to Latin music mogul, if I could use that word again?
Well, you know what? When I started, I was a huge fan of Duran Duran, Motley Crue. And then I had this passionate love for King Diamond and Slayer and Carnivore and all these other bands that just connected with me in a way that no other music genre did at that time. Then I used to study in Stamford, Connecticut, and decided to go back to Columbia to finish my studies. And they kind of gave me the wings to start working in music. And I went to this radio station, and the radio station took me on as an intern. And then from the intern, I went to do an interview with Michael Hutchins and NXS, and it went really well. So they kind of asked, so who's this girl? And they're like, eh, she's the intern. So I started as a radio promoter. I had no idea that there was a music business. And then the first thing they told me, it's like, you know what? We're going to bring you on as a radio promoter, and we're going to give you Toco. And Toco was this legendary dance music label with Two Unlimited and Two Brothers on the Fourth Floor and all these amazing dance artists. And I was just like, oh my God, what? I could only listen to Slayer and Halloween and Megadeth and Metallica, you know? And for me, this was like my worst nightmare come true. So I recorded a tape top to bottom and listened to it until I found the good qualities about it that I thought were worth mentioning as a selling point to the audience and to the radio programmer. No, I started seeing it from a different perspective.
Okay, so let me get from that story to the name of your company, Criteria Entertainment.
Right.
What are your criteria now, right?
Top criteria is that my team believes in the project. Mm-hmm. Because if the person that's representing you in whichever way, you know, shape or form, whether it's radio promotion or pitching you or managing you, if they don't truly believe in you, nothing's going to happen.
Right.
It starts from there. You know, they're your first salesman. And then obviously, you know, cater to the artist, but with a realistic view on the market. Every artist that I meet is like, I want to release tomorrow, and I want to release in all these territories. Yeah. And I'm like, why?
Because I want to.
Quiet.
It's my stuff.
Right.
I want to get it out there.
And I'm like,
right?
But you spent the year recording this album with 12 amazing tracks, and you want to all send it out tomorrow. And who's waiting for this, you know? So It's a conversation.
It sounds like you spend a lot of time being a downer, kind of, right? I mean, here's this artist with this stuff, this thing that she or he has been working on, and you're like, no,
I'm a manager of expectations.
There you go. That's right. Deanna Rodriguez, her company is called Criteria Entertainment. She's the CEO and the founder and clearly the driving force, I guess, right?
Oh, thank you so much.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, a preview perhaps of part of the 2020 general election campaign. Acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney did a thing at a Wall Street Journal event today. And skipping the outright political stuff about that other big story of this Tuesday, Mulvaney said in a second term, President Trump wants to lower corporate taxes even more. The GOP's 2017 $1.3 trillion deficit finance tax cuts cut corporate tax rates from 35% to 21%. A little bit less than 11 months till Election Day, right now, for what it's worth. Okay, we're done. Whole lot flat on Wall Street today. Dow Industrials off 27. NASDAQ down 5. S&P 500 gave back 3. Those are all points. The percentage is a 10% or less. Our digital and on-demand team includes Kerry Barber, Samantha Fields, Joanne Griffith, Ben Hethcote, and Sarah Menendez. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.